The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A21-1150, Damon Doss versus St. Paul Area Electrical JATC Registered Apprenticeship Program.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I know that you both are familiar with our procedures and you both will have 15 minutes for your arguments and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. If at any time there are technical glitches or I was just told by my colleagues that they sometimes can't hear me, raise your hand because we want to make sure that the technical issues don't get in the way. The arguments are being recorded. Please state your name at the beginning, and they will be posted soon on our court website. And with that, Mr. Cooper, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Stephen Cooper, representing the plaintiff, Damon Doss, in this matter. I should indicate at the beginning that I think there's a pretty good chance that I will not be able to get through all of the issues that may be before the court. And if that occurs, I stand on my filings for those issues. This is a case that arises—
Mr. Cooper, with your saying that, are there certain issues that you want to focus on for your argument?
There probably are, but I much prefer to focus on whatever the court wants me to focus on. And so I would welcome any direction that anybody feels is important in what I'm saying. And I'll just start and be ready to move to wherever you want to move me. This is a case that arises out of my client who had no electrical experience applying for and passing the test to become a JATC electrician. The only way to become an electrician in Minnesota, except for some rare circumstances, is to first go through the five-year JATC program. He came into that program. He had previously been to college and had an associate's degree, but he came into the program with no electrical training. The way he was treated thereafter was very different than almost any non-African-American applicant. Let's start off with the track record that JATC had. JATC had in the previous 4 to 5 years graduated one Black graduate and 152 non-Black. It had failed its affirmative action plan every single year that the plaintiff was in the program, and there were very, very few. Some years there were zero, but there were very, very few African Americans in the program. It had in its own policies and procedures and standards, it had admitted that there was a higher attrition rate for females and minorities, and that it was going to take steps to correct that, but it never did. What's important about that is they admit they never did.
Can we make anything of the fact that when these negative evaluations come in, no one questions those, no one digs into it, just accepts them, and see if you get five, you're out.
We can make a lot of that, Your Honor. And let's first start off with the fact that three of the five that you were used to terminate him came in his first three assignments, two within 2 months. He'd had no training from the JATC, didn't even start till months later. He hadn't yet gone to the outside training. And the third one that he failed also happened before he'd completed that training, but had just barely started it. And on that third one, beyond the fact that they're so soon, on that third one, you also had the fact he was segregated from the white apprentices. He was segregated from the white journey workers. He complained about that. When he complained about that, they did no investigation other than come out and talk to him. And he had been moved independent of his complaint within the same company to a different work site. So that supervisor was no longer supervising him. However, 6 months later, way after they were supposed to do it, when they did an evaluation of him, that's the supervisor who did it. Not the supervisor who he spent most of his time with, but that one who he complained about segregating him and treating him differently. Did that. Now that's the first three evaluations. Of the other two of the five that were used, and don't forget, he had by the time they terminated him, eight that were not fails. The majority were not fails. So when they come up with the last I lost my, oh, the last one that he was used was only for 6 days. It was a temporary assignment over Thanksgiving. The job was ending. He was there 6 days and they gave him a failing evaluation.
Mr. Cooper, I was going to ask you about the two negative evaluations that he received after he was accepted back in the program and before he was discharged permanently. Are you alleging that those were racially motivated?
What we're alleging is three things, Your Honor. First, even with those two, which I'll describe more detail in a second, he would not have had five. He would not have had five if he hadn't had those first three. They did not, and I think this is pointed out in our brief, with many of the other apprentices, they never even bothered to get their evaluations. Even though they only had four to five in their entire career, they never even bothered to get them. And in plaintiff's case, on those two that happened afterwards, what was very curious is they sent to the one employer that gave him a negative one, they sent her an evaluation to do, and then they sent her another one because they didn't get it back quickly enough. But the one before that he passed with a very high grade, they didn't bother to get till after they terminated him for the second time. So what you had is they were soliciting certain evaluations and not soliciting others. And the one they didn't solicit was a situation where he had been working there before they terminated him the first time. And then they asked, do they want him back? And they said, yes. And then they gave him a positive evaluation 6 months later when they finally sent it to him. So you have a pattern in practice here of they selectively sending out requests for evaluations. In his case, the two that were afterwards is basically we have, well, I think I've already described it, but they still would not add up to five if they did not have the discriminatory ones we've already talked about.
So I've got two questions here kind of related to that, Mr. Cooper. Number one, with the policy, I know they adopted the policy that, you know, five will result in termination, but did the policy prohibit termination from the program on less than five evaluations, depending on the nature of the evaluations? And then kind of secondly and unrelated is, you talk about this selective solicitation of evaluations. What evidence is in the record is there that the respondent engaged in a practice of selective solicitation?
Okay, let me go back and answer your first question first. And if I understood it, Your Honor, is could they fire somebody who had less than five negative evaluations? And yes, they could, but not probably for the evaluations. For instance, when my client got his fourth negative evaluation, the only sanction was a 1 week sanction. When a white individual got his fourth negative evaluation, there was no sanction whatsoever. He was merely told, do better. So what you have is a situation where these negative evaluations really don't mean very much. They're a fake badge. They're a fake thing that was made up. When we deposed some of the evaluators themselves, they said they'd had multiple negative evaluations when they were working there, but no consequence came from it. Let me go to your second question. We have Mr. Grimm, the training director, saying that many times they don't send back or get evaluations for many of the people that are being evaluated, or that should be evaluated. And don't forget, the average person should get 4 to 5 evaluations in their entire 5 years total. But some of them don't even get that because they never send it out or they never get it back and they do nothing about it. What we have in my client's case is he had, by the time he left, about 16 or 17 evaluations. That means 3 times as many as the average person. And he was only there for 2.5 years. And they kept sending him to short-term job after short-term job. And then they'd count these very questionable ones. And one of the people they use as comparator, he had a negative evaluation and they didn't count it because he was only there for 6 days. And that's RW and that's in our brief. Because he was only in that assignment for 6 days, they said that's not unworthy of being considered. Yet the one they fired my client for was one that had only been for 6 days. And when I say 6 days, I mean 6 working days. There's obviously, that was over Thanksgiving. Obviously they didn't work on Thanksgiving, but or the day after for that matter. So what we're looking at here, Your Honor, when you look at the totality of these circumstances, though, it's just so many things piled on top of each other. None of his complaints were ever investigated. They try to claim in their briefing there were no complaints that they were aware of. Yet we have in the documents that come from them, from Mr. Grimm saying that the very first time he went to the committee, he indicated he was being treated differently because of his race. and I'm paraphrasing, those aren't the exact words, you have on the day he was terminated later after.
Mr. Cooper, I have a question. Got myself unmuted. So okay. What are the objective facts that show that your client was qualified for the job, which is required for the prima facie case? Is there any case law supporting an analysis that we shouldn't look to negative performance evaluations at this stage of the analysis?
Yes, there's a lot of case law, and I cite it all in my brief, and that case law says you do not consider the reason for termination as to whether somebody is qualified or not. That comes in the next stage. That comes in the stage of what is your legitimate non-discriminatory terms. Now, in this case, what is the evidence? First of all, he passed the majority of his evaluations. Second of all, his overall average throughout the time period he was an apprentice was passing. Third of all, he passed the overwhelming majority of those after the first three. You know, he had those first three before he knew anything. And after that, he passed something like 8 in a row. The next thing you have is the two evaluators who evaluated him for the longest period of time gave him glowing praise and indicated he'd make a great electrician. And both of them, by the way, the only ones who've done sworn testimony, they both testified at the hearing. Nobody who gave a negative evaluation testified at that internal hearing. So what you have is the record, the only thing, and here's the key point, Your Honor, when they were asked, and I was quite startled by the answer I got, when they were asked, is there any correlation between 5 failed valuations and anything else? No, we pulled the number out of the air. So what they're saying is they have nothing to show that it's valid. They have nothing, and there was no problem they were curing. That's the other thing. They didn't have a problem. Their stated purpose, because it's an educational program, is to do everything they can to assist people at succeeding. And then after my client made multiple complaints about discrimination, they created this new rule. Almost all of the rules come from the national JATC. This one was created locally. It was created without following their local rules. Their rules require that when you're going to change a rule after you've signed a contract with a apprentice, you have to get him to sign off on it. They never did that. They started implementing this rule before they even had sent it, got any feedback from the state. What we have here then is also, and as we haven't got into, but there is extensive under Minnesota law and federal law, extensive responsibilities to assure equal opportunity. And they are laid out at length in our brief. They followed none of them. They admit they followed none of them. They were supposed to follow those. Everything as simple as alerting the evaluators to what the affirmative action equal opportunity pledge is. Never did that. Never talked to them. Never talked to them before or after the failed evaluations. And let's go back to your hard question. The one time that the committee members saw my client's work, they indicated it was very good. And that's when he did a presentation in front of them. So what we have on the positive side is virtually everything. What we have on the negative side is an invented new rule that's kind of like a cat chasing its tail, or is it a dog chasing its tail, whatever it is, where they're trying to say, hey, on the one hand, we made this rule. Therefore, if you don't pass this rule that we have no basis for, that constitutes a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. It doesn't. Going back to the beginning of your question, though, the law is very clear, and I cite those cases in my brief. You do not use a legitimate non-discriminatory reason to show that a person's not qualified for the job. You could show things like he lied and doesn't have his license, he cheated on the exam, things that are unrelated to the legitimate non-discriminatory reason. In this case, don't forget, nobody else was this rule ever used on, to the best of my knowledge, right up until today. This rule was only created after he had filed the wrong word, after he had made numerous complaints about, and don't forget the key, there's two key purposes to this whole program, and the biggest one is on-the-job training. They admit he repeatedly complained about the fact he did not get on-the-job training, and what they said to him, that's not our problem, go talk to the people you're working with. But the law, which is laid out very clearly in my brief, says, no, that is their problem. It's their responsibility to make sure the employers follow it, and they have the authority to remove an employer from the program if they don't. And that's all laid out very clearly. One of the things that's important here is there's been a historical drought of African-American electricians being employed. And so both the state and federal government decided to do something about that. And what they decided to do about it is say very clearly to the JATCs, it's your responsibility to take the steps necessary to assure equal opportunity. They did not do that here, and they admit they did not do it. That's not even a factual dispute. They admit they did not do it. So what we have then, I'm probably giving too long an answer to one question. I'll stop at that point and move on to some other things. The thing that's also very important, if you look at the case law we cite here, is this is not a unique problem with JATCs. There's other JATC cases that have ruled against the JATC's position here, that they are hands off and they don't have any responsibility. And those cases very clearly say, yes, you do. You do have the responsibility because you control the complete program under the law. It is you who are the people who are in charge of it. And they did not do that here. They also did not investigate the multiple complaints of racial statements. They claim they didn't know about them, but the evidence shows they clearly did know about them. And so you have a situation where they are not fulfilling the responsibilities that they have. I've only got 29 seconds left. Let me quickly just hit a couple of subjects very quickly in that few seconds. The trial court dismissed the companion complaint saying they were preempted. They're not preempted. The trial court simultaneously said an affirmative action plan is not direct evidence of a Title VII violation. I mean, it is direct evidence, but it's not in itself a violation of Title VII, yet these other two are preempted. As I lay out in my brief, they're not preempted. You can't have it both ways. You can't say Title VII doesn't cover and it preempts, because it doesn't. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Cummins?
Thanks very much, Your Honor. Can you hear me okay? Thank you. Justin Cummins, appearing on behalf of respondent. Appellant relies on misstatements of fact and law and filed its reply brief late. But more to the point, Your Honors, appellant ignores numerous undisputed facts that confirm the district court properly granted summary judgment. For example, appellant ignores the fact that the state's quasi-judicial proceedings already determined that the claims asserted by appellant have no merit, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that no merit determination. Appellant also ignores the fact that respondent readmitted appellant into the program while refusing to readmit the only other person besides appellant to be removed from the program for receiving 5 unsatisfactory performance evaluations from third-party employers. That other person is white. Appellant also ignores the fact that appellant's performance problems resumed almost immediately after respondent readmitted appellant. Despite over 2 years of classroom instruction and on-the-job training, third-party employers concluded in writing that appellant has, quote, no general knowledge, quote, needs to be supervised at all times, and, quote, just does not catch on. In addition, appellant ignores the fact that respondent provided extensive tutoring and other extra support to appellant to help appellant succeed.
Well, let me ask you this. How do we measure, and it's the kind of the flip side of what I asked Mr. Cooper, how do we measure whether an apprentice is qualified for the job, which is required for the prima facie case? Are the 5 negative evaluations dispositive? And if so, why don't the positive evaluations that he received create a genuine issue of fact?
Thank you, Your Honor. The policies at issue here were reviewed and approved by the state. And the state approved policies say that if you receive 5 unsatisfactory performance evaluations from employers, from these third-party employers, then you are not qualified to continue in the program. This is contrary to what counsel suggested. This is based on the fact that essentially a balancing of considerations. On the one hand, apprentices need the opportunity to learn the trade. On the other hand, third-party employers need to have employees that are going to do the job safely and efficiently. Working with high voltage electricity, it can kill people if you make a mistake and cause significant destruction. So the state approved policies that say 5 negative reviews by third party employers is a cutoff, is a valid basis for determining whether someone is qualified to continue in the program.
This troubles me about those negative evaluations, and that's that several of them came from employers who had engaged in potentially discriminatory conduct. One made a racial remark and another segregated Mr. Dawson. He had filed a complaint against him. Why don't those facts create a question, a factual issue with regard to the pretext prong?
Because, Your Honor, as to the alleged segregation, that pertains to Hunt Electric. And respondent went onto the job site to investigate the complaint of him not being treated well. And at that point, when respondent was on the job site, he said, things are fine. Don't do anything further. There's no problem here. So, and on top of that, the person that gave the evaluation did not know that appellant made a complaint about that supervisor. So the person that gave the evaluation had no knowledge at the time of giving the evaluation that that the appellant had complained in any way about the supervisor or anyone else at Hunt Electric. The other issue, and this is regarding Parsons Electric, the evaluation that was provided was like the timing here is important. The complaint that appellant made was roughly a year after the alleged racial remark. And appellant at that time couldn't even specify or would not specify who made the remark, exactly when the remark was made. In the construction industry, you have people revolving around construction sites. This is a very big company. And without that kind of information, there's no basis for the respondent really to do any kind of further investigation. And there's no evidence in the record that the evaluation by Parsons Electric was in any way tainted by racial animus on anyone's part. The fact is, and I need to address this as well, because counsel's made a big deal about the fact that appellant did not have prior experience or training with electrical work prior to being sent out in the field. That's how it works. All of appellant's peers are virtually all of them in the same boat. They come into the program, they do not have prior experience or coursework instruction in this area. They're put out in the field in that context. And it's important also to remember that the third party employers, not respondent, dictate how long the tenure is for any given apprentice, whether or why the particular apprentice's tenure with a particular employer ends. That's all in the employer's hands. The respondent does not have control over that. And there are a number of other employees of these third party employers who also had short stints. The question under the policy approved by the state is whether the employee has received a negative evaluation. And regarding appellant, these five third-party employers, each of them said that he performed poorly or below average regarding numerous aspects of work, ability to transfer training experience from one task to another within similar situations, overall mechanical ability and electrical trade, accuracy. Counsel, yes.
Counsel, with all of the responses that were affirmative responses or were responses that said he was doing a good job, it's hard for me to understand how five people would say he's not qualified and a whole bunch of other people would say he is.
Yes, Your Honor, and actually it's not quite accurate. If you look at all of the evaluations, it's roughly 50-50 in terms of the employers that gave negative evaluations versus those that gave.
Well, how many positive? How many positive evaluations were there?
I believe there were 7 or 8. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, Your Honor. But one thing to keep in mind is and counsel pointed to this, that the bulk of the time that appellant spent where he was evaluated as doing a positive job was working for the city of St. Paul. Doing public sector work is very different than doing private sector construction work. The pace of work in the public sector is much slower. The work is typically less complex. The private sector construction work is much more demanding. And so the fact that one employer, a public sector employer, thought that he was doing a fine job is really not dispositive. But it gets back to this fundamental point, which is the state-approved policies say that if you get 5 negative evaluations, then you have to be removed from the program. But those aren't the only reasons why.
Is that what the policy is, that you have to be removed?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how about the reinstatement? Because that's what occurred here.
That's right, Your Honor.
Did they violate the state policy on reinstating him?
No, they did not, Your Honor, because what the policy says is if someone receives 5 negative evaluations, they must be removed, which respondent did. But respondent at the time said, you should appeal this and we will reconsider the decision, because they were doing everything they could to work with him to help him succeed. And when he appealed, they granted the request to be readmitted under the condition that there be no same or similar problems. And when he was readmitted, same and similar problems proceeded. But if I could say, Your Honor, that the reason for removal the first time around wasn't just because of the 5 negative evaluations. He also appeared before the respondent 5 separate times for performance issues. And he had timesheet violations 4 times after being reminded in writing multiple times about the obligation to provide timesheet reporting even when he's not working. The respondent could have, but did not remove him when he received his 4th unsatisfactory performance evaluation from a third party employer.
Well, if we're talking about whether or not he's qualified, when you have evaluations going in every direction and you say it's 50-50, isn't there at least a fact question?
As to a prima facie case, no, and certainly not to the ultimate question, because the policy here says quite clearly, and again, this is a state approved policy, that if you receive 5 unsatisfactory performance evaluations, you're not qualified to continue in the program. But that's not the extent of the problems with appellant, his performance. He had to appear before respondent 5 separate times because of performance evaluations. The policies say, again, the state approved policies say, he could have been removed for that reason after coming before the respondent a 3rd time. And the respondent did not remove him at that point, nor when he appeared for a 4th time. The respondent didn't remove him then. Respondent also did not remove him after he was.
What does that mean? If they didn't remove him after the 3rd and 4th, there wasn't the real question about whether he understood his job and that he was qualified?
No, what that reflects, Your Honor.
It seems to me you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, you say 5 and you're out, but then you're saying, but he could have been out on 3, he could have been out on 4, and there's no fact question here. Seems to me like there are all kinds of fact questions here about. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, to clarify, the appearances before the respondent, what the policies say is that you may be removed. It's not mandatory. It's discretionary, if you will, that respondent could remove him after appearing before the respondent a 3rd time, a 4th time, a 5th time. The respondent did not remove him for appearing before them because of performance issues a 3rd time or 4th time, because they were trying to give appellant every opportunity to succeed in the program. But as to the unsatisfactory performance evaluations, those, it is mandatory. If you get 5, then you are removed. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And the timesheet one, is that one of the 5?
No, yes, the time, I believe 1 or 2 of meetings with respondent pertain to the timesheet violations. Not all of them, but 1 or 2 of them did.
Do those timesheet valuations have any evidentiary weight in terms of whether he's qualified for the job?
As to substantive performance, no, but what it goes to is compliance with rules, with policies and procedures, which when you're working with high voltage electricity, that's very important. These issues that we've been talking about, Your Honors, the state's quasi-judicial proceedings considered them and again determined that there was no merit, and the Court of Appeals previously affirmed that no merit determination.
Do you agree, Mr. Cummins, that there's record support for appellant's claim that he was singled out by being subjected to an inordinate number of evaluations compared to other candidates in the program, and also their claim that this policy that we're talking about was adopted in response to Mr. Doss in order to address his issues?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I don't agree with appellant's characterizations. Regarding the policy change, and we set this out in more detail in the briefing, but the decision to change the policies was made many, many months before before the appellant received the fourth negative evaluation. And it was a comprehensive review, which was done in coordination with the state. It was reviewed by the state, it was approved by the state, and it was to make the policies actually more lenient, because the apprentices were having challenges. Some apprentices were having challenges in terms of the program. And so it was a further effort by a respondent in general to try to help apprentices succeed. There is no evidence in the record that that appellant was targeted for unnecessarily short tenures or evaluations or anything like that. The third party employers, again, are the ones that are in control. They're the ones that are responsible for requesting labor. They're the ones that are responsible for determining the performance of the apprentices or the employees while on the employer's job site. They're the ones that are responsible for determining whether they're even going to do an evaluation, and whether or when they're going to and why they're going to terminate the employee's tenure. What the record shows that there are a number of other employees like appellant of each racial category that had short tenures with various employers, that had multiple employers like appellant did. Not all of the apprentices had as many assignments as appellant did, and that speaks to appellant's performance. But he wasn't the only one. There were certainly white apprentices, Asian apprentices, Indigenous apprentices, Latinx apprentices, who also had a similar experience in terms of the number of work assignments they had and the length of the assignments.
Mr. Cummins, your time is up. Before I turn to Mr. Cooper, do either of my colleagues have any more questions for Mr. Cummins? Okay, thank you. Mr. Cooper, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You're on mute. We haven't heard anything he said. We'll restart, or the clock hasn't started running yet.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
And those were my best points. No, going too specifically. Most of what opposing counsel said in his argument, or large parts of it, just are not supported by the record. Let's start off with his change of what the Court of Appeals, your court, said previously. They specifically, internally, they refused to do any discovery. They refused to consider the race issue at all and prohibited any testimony on it. Your court, when it got this, said, we are limited by what happened below. We're very troubled. I'll read it. We do think it is concerning that Doss was sent to 13 different job sites in less than 3 years when the average apprentice only has 5 to 6 during the 5-year term of the apprenticeship. We also think it is concerning that Doss received at least one of his negative reviews before he had received any training as an electrician. And that one of his reviews was filed by an employer that Doss complained about to the director. However, that's beyond the scope of what we have to decide here. So basically, this court specifically said that issue is for another day, and this is that other day. Opposing counsel tried that same argument at the trial court and lost it twice because it's an inaccurate argument, and he knows it. Now, let's go specifically into a lot of the other claims he made. I'm not going to get through them all. I'm just going to try to pick them up. He claimed that, first of all, he never addressed the fact that there's no other employee, period, that ever had 3 evaluations in the first 6 months that were used to terminate him. Nobody. what we see in this particular situation is the only people, and there's only nine of them, who had a large number in the last 10 years. The vast majority of those were minorities. They did that. There were only, I think, three whites out of those people. The others, and even though only about less than 10% of the total employees aren't white males, that's the only ones who had extra things. Now, as far as the, I'm trying to look through my notes here real quickly to see the things he said. Some of the things he said, I didn't even know what he was talking about, but particularly in light of the fact that we have here, the fact that Doss complained, and as you'll notice when you look at the AA rules, it is the obligation of the defendant, specifically the obligation of the defendant, to oversee and make sure non-equal protection doesn't happen. And the answer to your question before about the, do you consider the legitimate non-discriminatory reason in the capable for the job thing, and specifically yellow transportation out of the Eighth Circuit specifically says you do not, and it cites the fact that that's what everybody says. They say that you're mixing up two different steps. The step about qualified for the job is different than the reason for termination. Here we have opposing counsel keeps trying to glorify this rule. This rule was not done in collaboration with the state. When the state person was questioned about this in his deposition, he said, I don't even remember this, and I've had no training on equal opportunity. Almost all the rules that the JATC has are created by the national JATC. They're carefully examined and they're carefully put in place. This one was created only by the local, and they were claiming it was to make things more lenient. It didn't. What it did is, as a couple of judges have pointed out, it took away the discretion. You no longer had discretion as to whether this did or did not terminate. It tried to make it automatic that you terminate. And that just is not correct. Now, one of the things you're probably seeing between me and opposing counsel is there are tons of factual issues here. This is not a case that is appropriate to be decided on a summary judgment motion. This is clearly something that a jury should decide. Justin can make his arguments and I can make my arguments to the jury and provide our evidence. But there are sharp disagreements, particularly when you take the training director himself, Grimm. He's the one who called the plaintiff a liar in the termination meeting, and he's the one who stormed out of the meeting, and he's the one who said that the plaintiff was lying about not having training. And he said, but he admitted in his deposition, he didn't even know that. He just thought that. He claimed later he checked on it, but the person who says he checked and said, I never had such a conversation with him. You have here a situation where between opposing counsel and I, we have a very different view, both mine strongly supported by the record. And if you look at the brief, when you look at his claim that he made towards the end there is preposterous, his claim that they had no responsibility to what the employers were doing. If you look at the brief, particularly the first brief, it goes through that, it goes through it in the second brief, they had a clear responsibility. And why? The reason they did is because of the long-term history of no Blacks graduating from electrical training programs. And so most every evaluator we questioned said, have you ever had another Black apprentice? No. Do you have any Blacks working for you in your job sites? And these are huge companies. Only those that come from other states or the military. Do you know of any that are, I see my time is up.
Thank you to both of you. The briefing was thorough and the arguments helpful. And we will get our decision out within the 90 days. That concludes our oral calendar, and we're going to recess and consider these cases and then also our non-oral cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.